Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello, and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on what you need to know if you feel you have been wronged by a professional, aka professional negligence. I am joined by barrister Sarah Ibrahim from Three Hare Court Chambers in London. Sarah is regularly undertakes professional negligence claims, including cases that are pursued against a wide range of legal professionals. Sarah is ranked in the Legal 500 for her work in this field. Thank you so much for joining me, Sarah.
It's lovely to be here with you.
Lovely to have you back again. Right, professional negligence, put simply, is where a professional advisor provides advice which falls below the standard expected of that advisor, and as a result, you suffer a harm or a financial loss. In recent years, there has been a substantial growth in professional negligence claims, and it has been reported that insurers have paid out over £2 billion in the last 10 years. I mean, the pandemic is likely to have added to the number of professional negligence claims, given that supervision of staff and office communication became much more difficult for a long period of time. In this episode, Sarah and I will be giving you information that you need to know if you have been wronged by a professional, points to consider if you think you may have a claim for professional negligence, and much, much more. Sarah, let's start by having a quick chat about what the difference is between information and advice. I mean, doesn't a professional always advise whether they're giving you information or not?
Hattie, I think this is a great question because you're right. Lots of professionals don't just describe themselves as a professional, but a professional advisor. So if you're going to use that term, how could you not be providing advice? Well, this goes to a Supreme Court decision that was made before COVID. So there was an exciting case, well, if you're a professional negligence lawyer, it's exciting, called Hughes Holland and BPE. And this created what's called a legal term of art. So essentially what lawyers think of as special phrases of information and advice. Well, Hattie, why is that relevant? Well, broadly speaking, the court decided if you were only providing information, you weren't liable, whereas if you were providing advice, then you were. But this became really unhelpful because you can imagine for all of the insurers who were defending these kinds of claims, what would they say? My client was only providing information. They weren't providing advice. Now, if you're the poor person who would approach the professional advisor, you were getting very confused as to what the distinction was.
I have to say, I mean, that is a fine, fine, fine line. And I can just see it. Anybody arguing on behalf of the professional to say this was not negligent advice, this was literally information, you can spend days dicing that up in court and tearing that apart. But yes, it is a fine line when somebody says, well, is that information or is that advice? And how does that even get pulled apart? How do you define that? I know each case is very different, but what are your thoughts on that? How do you define that?
Well, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. Lawyers had an absolute field day with this. And I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there have been some exciting professional negligence developments during the pandemic. You may have missed them, Hattie. You could have been busy doing other things. But essentially, the Supreme Court's put a bit of a stop to this because the cases were going in the wrong direction. They were focusing on this very, very narrow division as opposed to what did the professional agree to do and was there in fact a liability?
Yes, no, I get it. I hear you. I mean, given that a duty of care is a legal duty, right, requiring the professional to act with a standard of care and skill when dealing with their client, there are circumstances where a duty of care can be discharged. So perhaps we can look at that when answering this question. So are there occasions when a professional doesn't owe a duty of care at all?
Well, you're going to think I'm a pedant of the worst order. It depends who you are. So when it comes to duty of care, who does the professional owe the duty to? You could be a third party, for example. They may not have got the agreement with you. Or, and I know this sounds very morbid, but the client, the person who had the letter of retainer with the professional, may have died. and therefore the client's professional representatives may no longer be representing the estate. So there can be all sorts of details like that. What, Hattie, if it happens if you're a director? Are you instructing the professional on your own behalf as an individual or on behalf of the company? So you need to be very careful as to who the duty of care is owed to. But that isn't the entire story, because sometimes people don't get a formal contract. Now, Hattie, for those people who are listening now and they're thinking about this, do try and get a contract, because otherwise you have to argue, is there an implied retainer? Is there an implied agreement between you and the professional? And Hattie, that's difficult.
Well, I'll tell you what, this podcast is getting more legally than ever, like I expected at all, because you're absolutely right. It opens all these questions before you actually even look at, was the advice or the action negligent or not? I.e. who is the professional contracted with? How has it impacted you if you're a third party? And you mentioned there a scenario which is interesting. Was the negligence carried out and directly affected somebody who's passed away? And as a third party looking after the estate or a beneficiary of that estate, have you been affected as a result? Goodness gracious. And this is before you even talk about other bits and pieces. But I mean, when somebody has to look at, well, what is my claim potentially worth? Okay. And then you've got different areas. You've got the financial losses and you've got the medical losses. And I know we're going to go on to speak about that in relation to a Supreme Court judgment that was made that has changed that slightly and brought it closer together. But what are the basic principles for someone to work out what a claim is worth? It's interesting to note that according to National Health Service Litigation Authority, the average NHS negligence payout was estimated at around £50,000. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but it's not about what other people may have got in their claims. As you say, it's about what your claim is worth and how do you work that out. Well, to put it at its most basic, the damages are trying to put you back into the position you would have been if your professional had acted competently.
Pause there and repeat that, because that's very interesting. Looking at what would be the position for you had the negligence not have occurred. That's a big question really, Sarah, because say for example you will never be able to be put back in that position. How on earth do you measure that? The loss was so big that you can't ever be. And if it's a medical issue, and I was just talking about a medical issue with you before we press record, if you're never going to be put back medically into the position that you would have been in had the negligence not have been carried out, is there some sort of formula for, you know, for stuff like that?
Hattie, as you say, that's a really tough question, which means you often need an expert to work it out for you. So you're talking about a medical situation there. You would often instruct a medical expert to work out what the cost to you has been of that negligence, because yes, it is very difficult for you as an individual if you don't have that expertise to do that.
No, absolutely. And I know, you know, the information documentation that you need to put before a lawyer if you want to take some advice, I think I will ask you what your views are on that. But one of the key things, you just said a massive word there, and it's called an expert, an independent expert valuing your loss, whether it's financial or whether it's medical, is key. And I think that to also mention that if you are thinking of instructing an expert and you do have the opportunity to instruct a joint expert, meaning that you go to the other side, the other party, and you offer and you say, look, let's jointly instruct someone, so we've both agreed who that person or persons need to be, and let's get an expert opinion on the situation. That is going to help everybody before any claim is potentially issued or any value to your claim can be put. It's a key part to anything. But what other information documentation do you think a lawyer needs to see, Sarah, before someone comes to them and says, look, this is what's happened, what can I do?
Hattie, this is like me putting together my wish list. So
what I would like to see, put together the wish list, Sarah. I love the wish list.
So if there's a contract between you and the professional, your lawyer definitely wants to see that, because they want to know what the express terms are that were agreed. Sometimes you may not have that, but where you do have it, it is essential. Sometimes your expert, they may be a surveyor, they may be an accountant, they will have provided something as part of their services, so you'll want to see the set of accounts, or you'll want to see the report they've provided, because that is essential as well. Now, you will know, during this pandemic, everything has been reduced to emails and texts and messages. So where those have been exchanged between you and a professional, put them all together, you know, whether it's electronically or hard copy, so your lawyer can go and review the whole exchanges that you've had.
Yes.
I would also ask, if you're up for a bit of homework, because this can be helpful for your lawyer, do a chronology, because to understand when the expert was first approached and when things happened is so useful for a lawyer. And if you've still got a bit of energy, if you write a short narrative of what you say happened and what you say went wrong, that it can also be a useful jumping off point for your lawyer.
Yes, no, key points there. And actually, a chronology where you say, right, I'm going to just put the date and one sentence, if it's one sentence after, exactly what happened on that date, or two sentences, it will also help you get your thought process and remember how things unfolded from the very, very start. It's very helpful and very constructive to do things like that. Do you do direct access, Sarah?
I do bits of direct access. So, Hattie, the important thing is, when it comes to direct access, that the client who wants to instruct the barrister can deal with all of the paperwork themselves.
Yes, yes.
The barrister is doing things like the pleadings. They will help draft letters, but only certain barristers can enter into correspondence. So it's important that you agree with your barrister what you are doing on your case and what the barrister is doing on their case.
Yes, I mean, I say it on many, many podcasts. For those listeners that aren't sure what direct access is, it's when you as a layperson can go directly to the bar, to a set of chambers, and instruct a barrister directly, if the barrister does have a license for direct access. In this case, Sarah does. But not all cases are geared up for direct access, because it could be very heavy on the administrative side, on the document side, and barristers do not do that side of the works. And as Sarah said, you have to be geared up to be able to do that with some guidance, but it can be a lot cheaper than instructing a law firm that then instructs a barrister for you. Okay, we have got time to discuss at length two more areas, actually, which is very rare I say that. But since we last spoke, we did a professional negligence part one podcast. There was a Supreme Court judgment on this area. Has that changed anything?
It has, and your timing of this podcast is so good. I assume that you're a professional negligence enthusiast. So the Supreme Court, just before the summer last year, actually, it was a two for the price of one decision, Hattie. So there was the headline case of Manchester Building Society versus Grant Thornton, but there was a linked case of Khan versus Meadows. And if I'm allowed, I'm going to try and touch on both.
Please do.
The Supreme Court, though, has come out with six key questions. So instead of the Herculean task, you've got the six questions that you need to answer when you're bringing a claim. And I'm going to try and make these as simple as possible, because the Supreme Court did put it in a slightly more finessed way than I.
Yes, of course.
So the first one is the loss you've suffered, is it actionable negligence? So that should be, does it fall within the kind of the tort of negligence? That is relatively easy. The second one, and this is really important, it's called the scope of duty question. So when you talk about this duty of care, which we've discussed earlier today, how extensive was that duty? Three, the breach question, and all clients feel they can answer this one. Did my professional breach their duty of care? If you're going to a lawyer, almost invariably you'll say, yes, they did. The fourth question is what's called the factual causation question, or as I say to lay clients, did the breach of duty cause you to suffer loss? So it doesn't just matter that there's been a breach of duty, because there may have been, did it actually cause the loss?
You see, five. I just want to say on that, Sarah, just before you come to number five, in the US, and I've been saying this for years, if you've been become distressed, if it's affected you emotionally and you've become distressed over a situation, there is a value to that. In the UK, I don't see that the courts attach a value to the distress and the discomfort and the worry and the sleepless nights and all of that sort of effect when it comes to professional negligence. Are we going to catch up with that at any point, do you think, Sarah?
Well, we do copy a lot of what's going on in the US, but I think that the Supreme Court, having set down these six questions relatively recently, we may have to wait a while before the next set of Supreme Court decisions. But as you've probably pointed out in this podcast many times, the law is always an evolving creature.
Yes, an old evolving creature. Yes, no, sorry, please carry on with point five. You're on point five of the what needs to be tested and answered if you are going to assess whether you have a professional negligence claim.
Exactly, point five out of the six questions. So point five is what the Supreme Court very pithily called the duty nexus question. And Hattie, I can see...
The what?
Face.
What did you say? The what?
The duty nexus question. Ooh. I can see from your face you're thinking...
I'm thinking, what on earth is that?
Okay, so it's basically looking at whether there is a sufficient link between a particular element of the loss, which we're seeking damages for, and the duty of care. So you're looking there at the connection. What is the connection between what you've lost and the duty that was owed to you? So that's what it means in a nutshell.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure there are lawyers who would give lectures on that, but Hattie, you're not going to let me do that.
Yes, we might do a podcast just on that one day, but you put it so eloquently and simply, Sarah, that it's brilliant. Thank you for that.
And six, which I think is a really key one, it's about legal responsibility. So when it comes to your damages or your loss, are they recoverable? Because in law, the defendant can argue your losses are too remote. They're too far removed from the breach of the duty of care to be recoverable.
Now, that's a conversation in itself. Are your losses too far removed? How? Give me an example of when losses, for example, can be too far removed, because I can't think of one right now.
So, and this is me being very, very trite, but say, for example, you had a problem with a survey done and you got a house that you thought was unsafe and you were making a claim against the surveyor for negligence. Say your beloved dog ran away because you were very angry and you were shouting to your solicitor down the phone about this case and your dog died. That would be too remote because it wouldn't have been thought about by the parties when they're talking about the surveyor's breaches of their duty.
I see. So you're trying to deal with the loss that you had, which is I'm telling my lawyer solicitor that I've got bought an unsafe house. And while you're doing that, the dog runs away and an unfortunate event happens and it dies. And you're trying to claim the losses of your, add the losses of your pet that's died to the claim on the unsafe property purchase. Right. I get that. Okay. That I can work with that.
And you often get that in professional negligence because you've mentioned the distress you suffer. So it can sometimes feel like the negligence is the start of a series of events that go wrong.
Yes.
But when it comes to professional negligence, the lawyers will be looking, are all of those losses recoverable or are some too remote? I also, Hattie, if you don't mind, want to mention mitigating your loss.
Yes.
Because it's very important. For example, if because of negligence you've lost your job, you will be told by your lawyers you need to try and reduce your losses, i.e. you need to try and get another job if you are capable of getting another job.
Yes, yes, no, indeed. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? It's such a vast area of law, and the law just isn't comprehensible to most people in the way that it's delivered at the moment. And I say it, this is why we do this podcast, but there's so many elements to each case. Every issue that you might have, particularly this kind of area, professional negligence, is very unique to you and your circumstances and what has happened. It's key to always get advice. It's key to get independent experts' opinions, whether you go for two or one or joint or separate individual, you separately to the other side. These are key elements to where you are with it all. But one of the things that you mentioned, and that I, in everyday life, it's just normal that it can happen, is one thing, one event, one incident, one loss can trigger other losses because as a result of. So when we talk about if losses are too far removed, they might not be claimable within a professional negligence claim, are we saying that losses really have to be directly attached to the claim rather than it potentially being a trigger domino effect of losses, and the loss right at the end of that is something that you may not be able to attach? And I mean, I know this is a massively generic question and not specific to any one person's case. Do you see what I'm saying, Sarah?
I do. It is a lot easier to claim the losses that you've described that are directly connected. There are some exceptions because, Hattie, there always are arguments that can be made.
Arguments in the law? Never.
So, if I was to try and make an argument, if you have a domino-style case, one thing you would talk about is what did you say to your professional at the time? So, for example, if you had a case where you were claiming losses and you wanted to say that I would have invested some of that money, and therefore my loss isn't just what I've lost, it's the investment loss as well, you would have had to have drawn that to your professional's attention at the time. So there are ways and arguments that can be made to bring some of those things in. However, when I talk about it being easier, the reason it is more difficult when you have a domino-style case is because you can talk about things that have intervened. So things which aren't the responsibility of the professional. So other people may have come in and done things which have interrupted that link. You know, we've been talking about links, that causative link,
yes,
between things. So it is a lot easier when it's directly related, but there are some cases where you can make arguments as to why they could be included.
No, that's I get it. I hear what you're saying. And, you know, it goes back, doesn't it? Every case is very unique. Every situation, every event is very unique. But lastly, I want to pick your brains on this. What, you know, we talked about the 6-stage test. Do you think that the test has changed what needs to be proved to have a successful claim? Do you think those 6 stages are sort of groundbreakingly new and fresh to this area of law, which gives the consumer, gives the everyday person a little bit more clarity, a little bit more direction and structure to actually what does a claim have to look and feel like to be valid?
Well, I love those two words you've used of clarity and structure, because I think that's what it does. And I think the Supreme Court, very right at the start when we talk about information and advice, it kind of sent cases off in a slightly wrong direction. And I think that this brings it back with a really nice framework. But a lot of cases were being argued on the grounds of stages 4 to 6 as opposed to the early bits. And the early bits were, what exactly did the professional agree to do? And how extensive was their duty to you? And what this does is change the emphasis rather than the law. So the emphasis is telling you why all the components are important and the order in which you address them. So I think if you're a claimant, it's an awful lot clearer what you need to do to put your case together.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful stuff. I just thought of the title for podcast number three in this area, and I tell you what I think it should be. I think it should be professional negligence where professionals didn't mean to make the error. It was an unknown error to them. It was, you know, human nature. It was just an error. I think that's very interesting, because we're assuming that a professional perhaps here will say, well, I didn't do anything wrong. But what about when a professional says, hey ho, I get it, I did something wrong, I'm sorry, how does that get viewed? That is another podcast. So Sarah, for today, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me, Hattie.
It's been splendid speaking to you. And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. go to our website at redbarlaw.com